the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
As you will realise if you've been here over the last few weeks or any part of them, we're going through a series at the moment about the life of Gideon, whom Brian was referring to as we took communion together earlier. And we've reached the point of the big battle that gave Gideon his real and lasting fame. So we haven't got long to cover a very, very important chapter indeed, Judges chapter 7. And let's get started without any further ado. We've called it this morning, Faith is the Victory, and you'll see why when we look at the story. So we're going to read from Judges chapter 7. If you have a Bible there, let's have a look at that. That's the seventh book of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and chapter 7, but you knew that. Okay, fair enough. It's a long chapter, so let's read some verses to start with, and then we'll read more as we go through. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her. Announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them out for you there. If I say this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink." 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets, that's going to be important, of the others. We'll read more in a minute. This is probably one of the most successful authors of our time. His name is Malcolm Gladwell, and he's written a whole series of books about success. There's Outliers, which talks about the kind of person who's successful. There's The Tipping Point, about how little things can make a big difference. There's Blink, which is about the difference between instinctive thinking and reasoned thinking. And his whole career really has been built on showing people what they can do by themselves. This is his model of success, for instance. If you want to reach success at the top of the pyramid, you need something like 10,000 hours of practice, lucky opportunities, a cultural legacy, the right upbringing, and timing. Not easy. But the message of the books, which has made him so successful, is you can do it. People can do this sort of stuff. It's possible. You have the resources. You just need to study how you put those things to work. But now he's written a very different kind of book. It's called David and Goliath. What used to annoy me about Gladwell was that although some of his books, particularly The Tipping Point, which I recommend, are very, very insightful indeed, God never came into the issue. You see, it was about what I can do by myself. And I happen to know that Gladwell grew up in an American Mennonite family. In fact, he estimated at one point he was the only member of his family who had never delivered a sermon. He's now changed that. And through working on David and Goliath, he came to realize that success just doesn't depend on yourself. He wanted to do something about underdogness, as he puts it. People who start with very little, but through their faith get a long way. It all started when he went to interview a couple whose daughter had been murdered brutally 30 years before. Wilma and her husband Cliff were called into the local police station, he says, and told the news. Candace's funeral was the next day, followed by a news conference. Virtually every news outlet in the province was there because Candace's disappearance had gripped the city. This is Winnipeg, by the way, in Canada. "How did you feel about whoever did this to Candace?" a reporter asked the Dirksons. "We'd like to know who the person or persons are so we could share, hopefully, a love that seems to be missing in these people's lives," said Cliff. Wilma went next. "Our main concern was to find Candace. We found her. I can't say at this point I forgive this person." But the stress was on the phrase at this point. We've all done something dreadful in our lives or felt the urge to. And Gladwell says, I wanted to know where the Dirksons found the strength to say those things. A sexual predator had kidnapped and murdered the daughter. And Cliff Dirksen could talk about sharing his love with the killer. And Wilma could stand up and say, we have all done something dreadful in our lives or have felt the urge to. Where do two people find the power to forgive in a moment like that? And talking to the Dirksons, she realised it was faith. It was a faith in God. And so now Gladwell's saying in interviews, I've rediscovered my faith. I'm calling myself a Christian again. I drifted away a little bit, Gladwell said of his faith. This is an interview last week. This book has brought me back into the fold. I was so incredibly struck in writing these stories by the incredible power faith had in people's lives. It's made a profound impact on me in my belief. That's been the completely unexpected effect of writing this book. I'm in the process of rediscovering my own faith again. There are times when you cannot do it yourself, when you have to reach out and claim a power that's beyond you. That's the story of Gideon, the smallest in his tribe, the most unlikely hero in Israel's history so far, yet somebody who, when he laid hold in faith of the resources that God had for him, was able to do big things. And if you're a Christian this morning, that's true of you. There are situations you can't take on. There are enemies you can't deal with. Those great enemies that Brian was speaking about, of sin and death, we can't cope with those, but there is somebody who can. And his power in us can make a difference. You may remember, if you've been to this series before, that we're also suggesting a verse for you to think about each week, perhaps to memorize. And the verse for this week is this one, from Romans chapter 8, verse 11. The Spirit of God who raised Jesus from the dead lives in you. If you're a Christian. And just as God raised Christ Jesus from the dead, he will give life to your mortal bodies by the same Spirit living within you. You try to serve God. You try to live the right way. You try to overcome your problems. You're like a dead, inert piece of meat. But if the Spirit of God infuses you with his power, then you can do anything. And it's through faith that happens. But what is faith? Well, I want to say three very simple things about it in the next few minutes. And here's the first one. Faith means giving up trust in your own resources. Gideon had 32,000 men. That was not bad. It would be a close run encounter between the hosts of Midian and Amalek and him. But he had enough of an army to make a decent showing of it. And then God says, you've got too much. There are too many men here. You need to get rid of them. So he says, okay, if any of you want to go home, you can go home. A silly offer. Of course they wanted to go home. 22,000 left at a stroke. 10,000 left, and Gideon's doing the calculations and thinking, well, by some kind of miracle, we might just win. And God says, Gideon, too many. Oh, no! And so they go down to the river. Some drink in one way, some drink in the other. 9,700 go one way, 300 go the other. So Gideon says to God, okay, God, I'll send these 300 home and we'll do it with it. Oh, it's the other way around. 300 men to face the whole host of Midian. What chance do you stand? But you see, God had said, listen, if you do it any other way, you'll be tempted to think you did it. And I want to make it very, very clear, I did it. And you know, you can see that principle running through history again and again. You can see it if you just look around you. Here in Exeter, we're in the city of the guy who, I suppose, more than anybody else, stands behind this church. Because he started a movement in the 19th century that led directly to Belmont Chapel. I've been reading his story this last week in a book called The Father of Faith Missions. He was a dentist called Anthony Norris Groves. And he was well off. He lived in a big house, Northern Hay House in the city, had a good practice, was well liked by everybody. And he decided that he had to give it all away. He wrote a book called Christian Devotedness, in which he said, listen, why has the gospel not got further than it has through the last 15 centuries? Because we've lost this idea that we have to live in faith and dependence on God, not in our own resources. And so he decided eventually that God was calling him and his wife and their children to go out to Persia as missionaries. And he did that. Went on to India too. And in the process, he gave away his dental practice to one of his family. Wouldn't take a penny for it. Spent every penny he had and said, right, we're just going to trust God. And his example was tremendous, because that's why the book says he was the father of faith missions. Other people in the 19th century then started saying, well, if you can do that, if you can go out and just depend on God, if God is going to supply your needs, then we can go to places we never thought of going. We can do things we never thought would be possible. We don't need to be confined by the financial limits because God will meet our needs. And a burst of missionary enterprise went out from the work of Anthony Norris Groves and this city right here that transformed the state of Christian mission. People believing that when you don't trust your own resources, but you trust God's, then you can make big things happen. Just as Groves was giving away his dental practice down the road in Plymouth, another Exeter boy died. This is Robert Hawker, very successful preacher, born near St. Mary Arches here in Exeter, but spent 50 years as the vicar of that church, Charles Church in Plymouth, which you've probably seen it next to the Drake Circus shopping centre. Only the spire and the building around it is left. The church was bombed in the Second World War, and the rest has been left there as a memorial to the Second World War. But it's a memorial for Christians for other things as well, because Hawker was an incredible man. He had very little money, but he made it go a very long way. And he was convinced that if his church was going to do anything in Plymouth, it was going to meet need. And so he started a ministry to prostitutes. Plymouth was a wild and woolly town in those days. And took hundreds of girls off the street. And people just started giving him money so he could do it. He started the Misericordia Society to give money to people in need wherever it was needed. He began the second Sunday school in the world. Robert Rakes, a tailor in Gloucester, had just started the first one to take poor children off the streets, give them an education, teach them the gospel. He thought that's a fantastic thing. And so he started a Sunday school as well. And in fact, built the first purpose-built Sunday school in the history of the world. It sadly got bombed in the Second World War as well. But he did it with nothing. The building cost £900 to build. That was a lot of money in those days. And people said, you'll never do it. This is crazy. He said, well, we're going to call it the Household of Faith. The building was built. Started with 20 children. Within a year, it was meeting the needs of 371. And so it went on. You can see these examples all around you. Faith is when you stop trusting your own resources and you start trusting God's. Second thing, faith means facing your difficulties steadily and realistically. This is where we need to feed in a little bit more of chapter 7. This is verse 8 onwards. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley. During that night, the Lord said to Gideon, get up, go down against the camp, because I am going to give it into your hands. If you're afraid to go, go with your servant Purah and listen to what they're saying. Afterwards, you'll be encouraged to attack the camp. So he and Purah, his servant, went down to the outpost of the camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern peoples had settled in the valley thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. And Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend his dream. I had a dream, he was saying. A round loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed. His friend responded, this can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands. When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped God. He returned to the camp of Israel and called, get up, the Lord has given the Midianite camp into your hands. See, some people think that faith is when you don't notice the problems. You just plunge boldly in there and say, the Lord will provide, God will take care of my situation. It's not like that. The bravest soldier in a battle isn't the one who just wades in waving his sword above his head without thinking about the dangers. The bravest soldier is the one who's looked at the dangers, realizes how likely he is to get killed, really doesn't want to be there, but goes anyway. And that's faith. Not ignoring the difficulties, but taking a good reckoning of them. Do you remember when Nehemiah was sent back to rebuild the city wall in Jerusalem? What was the first thing he did? At night, when nobody knew what he was doing, he took some men and just a few horses with muffled hooves and went round the walls and saw just how big a job it would be to rebuild the whole thing. And so the next day when he came to the Israelite legion, he said, God has sent me back to rebuild the walls. And he said, but you don't know. You've never been here. You don't know what a problem it is. It's a total stupid pipe dream. He'd get his little file of facts and say, yeah, I know exactly what's going to be involved. I've studied the problem carefully. I know what it's going to take, but I know my God is big enough to do it. So faith means facing your difficulties steadily and realistically, realizing what's going on. and still trusting God, still keeping on going. Another thing that Malcolm Gladwell said was this: the very thing that makes people so intimidating can be the source of their greatest weakness. That's the whole thesis of that new book, David and Goliath. The idea that Goliath was such a big, heavy bloke, he could win a conventional fight hands down. But when David saw that he was slow on the move, that he had no answer to David's sling, then his biggest source of strength was also the source of his greatest weakness. He was big and he was massive, but he couldn't get out of the way of a stone hurtling at 95 miles an hour. And so often when you look at the enemy, when you look at the problem, it doesn't daunt you. Instead, you see God's way through. And that's exactly what happened to Gideon, wasn't it? Because he started to realize that the Midianites were terrified. They were having dreams about their tents being knocked over. No, this has got to be Gideon. They had no idea that Gideon just had 300 men left. Their intelligence system wasn't all that great. And so they were scared silly. And Gideon started to see a way that God could win the victory. This is one of my great heroes of the 19th century, a man called David Livingstone. One of the greatest explorers and missionaries the world has ever seen, I guess. And Livingstone was somebody who was notable as an explorer and a missionary for the care he took in his provisions. For one thing, he was reputed to have crossed the whole face of Africa without ever firing a shot in anger. As you can see, he's got a pretty redoubtable rifle there, but he rarely used it. Why? Because he thought ahead. He made friends with people. He made alliances. He knew how to approach tribes and make himself loved by them. He was also notable for having traveled all over the place with very, very little fever or tropical disease amongst him or his native bearers or anything. And that's because as a doctor, he was very, very careful about hygiene and the way his men treated themselves and so on and so forth. He was somebody who thought everything through. And there was one night when he was camped on the shores of a river, knowing that he had to cross that river the next day and that there were two hostile tribes on the other side who just wanted to chop him into little pieces. And some of his followers were telling him about this and saying, you've got to run away. Others were saying, cross now under cover of darkness. Then they won't know you've gone until you've disappeared. And he prayed about it. And he spent the night thinking about the problem. And in probably his most famous diary entry, he wrote this: felt much turmoil of spirit in view of having all my plans for the welfare of this great region and teeming population knocked on the head by savages tomorrow. But I read that Jesus came and said, all power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, and lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. It is the word of a gentleman of the most sacred and strictest honor, and there's an end on't. I will not cross furtively by night as I intended. It would appear as flight. And should such a man as I flee, nay, verily, I shall take observations for latitude and longitude tonight, though they may be the last. I feel quite calm now, thank God. Well, he did it, calmly, the next day. Nobody appeared to attack him. They were there, but for some reason they didn't attack. And not through any power or planning or wiliness of his own, but simply through faith in God, he survived. Not that you always survive. Here's a picture that's been in the papers quite a bit this week. James Foley, that reporter who was horrendously beheaded the other day by the militants who were keeping him captive. One of the things you may not know about Foley was that he was captive before in Libya for some months. And what kept him going was his very, very strong and deep faith in God. You see, he saw what he was doing as a mission. God had sent him to the troubled spots of the world to serve him. And when he was in prison in Libya before, his family and friends back at home were praying for him. And he said that that was probably what kept him going, his prayers and their prayers. People who had faith that God could bring him out of this thing. And he wrote in a letter in 2011, which has just been published in the papers this week, these words: maybe it was others' prayers strengthening me, keeping me afloat. If nothing else, prayer was the glue that enabled my freedom, an inner freedom first, and later the miracle of being released during a war in which the regime had no real incentive to free us. It didn't make sense, but faith did. And it was that faith that sent him out again, knowing he could be killed, but knowing that if that happened, God was in control of the circumstances and he would go wherever God wanted him to go. That's faith. not running away from the difficulties mentally and imaginatively, but facing up to them and seeing God's solution coming through them. Final thing I've got to say, because we're almost on time, is faith means stepping out into the dark. This is where you get the great story of the victory. Let's just read a few verses. We don't have time to read the whole thing. But in verse 16, dividing the 300 men into three companies, Gideon placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them, "follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon." And so Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp. Just after the guard had been changed, they blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars. Grasping the torches in their left hands, holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!" While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. Now, Gideon had a great strategy. He knew the Midianites were nervy, but he still had to go over the top and do it. And it was great, wasn't it, that he took the lead himself. He modeled the behavior he wanted the others to follow. "When we get to the top of the hill, watch me." And it must have been one of the most nerve-wracking moments in his life when he took that step of faith and stepped out into the dark, smashed the jar, made the torch visible, started the trumpets blowing. That was going over the top in a big way, wasn't it? Faith sometimes means doing things you don't expect to do. Things that you don't know how they're going to turn out. I spent the last week in Roscoff in Brittany and been hearing the stories of the onion johnnies who used to come across to this country in big numbers and sell onions on the streets of Britain. Why did they come? They'd had no market in France was why. And in 1828, a young man called Henri Olivier had the idea that maybe there was a market just across the water, because in Plymouth and Exeter, they'll buy anything and their onions are rubbish. And so people started, when he went there, people thought, "This is crazy. You don't even speak English." And most of the onion johnnies through the 20th century haven't spoken much English, although they've developed a strange vocabulary of their own with words like le capotis, which they were offered at different houses. And it's a fantastic story, really, of the way in which up to 5,000 people were involved in loading the onions onto the boats, going across, spreading out right across the face of Britain and making an income for their families. They were away for home for months. They had no guarantee of success, yet they did it. That's what faith is about. Stepping into the dark, doing something that you're not sure about, but nonetheless, you're going to give it a try. And when it's faith in God that's involved, then you know he's not going to let you down. Out of that whole thing has come Brittany Ferries. At one point, they couldn't get across the channel, so they thought, right, fair enough, we will invent our own ferry company and take the onions. And as you know, Brittany Ferries is now one of the biggest ferry companies, holiday companies in Europe, just because people had a goal and went for it. Last week, Dave was talking about the fleece on the hillside. You know, this is Gideon, by the way, that Gideon put out. And people sometimes talk about, oh, before you do anything risky, you should lay out a fleece. Say to God, yes, I will go and be a missionary in Borneo if I win the national lottery next week. Mm-hmm, that's right. That's ungodly. And that's not the point of that story. It did not mean that we can set tests for God to pass. If you do that for me, then I will do this for you. You can't bargain with God like that. And people who have that kind of thinking miss something important in that story, which is that if you look back to chapter 6, Gideon had already called up his army by the time he did the fleece stunt with God. And so if he got up in the morning and looked at the fleece and it was wet when it should have been dry or dry when it should have been wet, he had a whole army to explain that to. He went to them and said, sorry guys, we're not going to fight the Midianites. Why? Because this fleece is wet. What? It's crazy. And it wasn't a case of, if you do this miracle, God, then I will do what you've asked me. No, Gideon was already obeying. He was already doing. He'd already stepped out in the dark. And you'll find that, won't you? That when you are going along the risky line of faith with God, God will send confirming signs. God will send things like the fleece again and again to say, yep, you're on the right lines, you're heading in the right direction, you're doing the right thing. But he won't do it first before you take the step. You need to go over the top. So it's not about setting tests for God to pass. It's about God giving us confirming signs when we're already doing his will. So in this situation, Gideon had to go right over the top. You can see on the map, The Midianites are in that red circle in the middle. Gideon is on the hills around. He has 300 men blowing trumpets and waving torches, and it sounds like a much bigger army. Why? Because they had all the torches that had been left behind by the guys who had gone home. You see, normally in those days, if you had 300 trumpets, you'd have at least 30,000 men. And so 300 trumpets all blowing at once made the Midianites think, this is a massive army, we're going to get slaughtered. And so they started in panic fighting the first thing they came across, which meant that most of them died by friendly fire, and the others ran away. Fantastic victory. Biggest victory Israel had seen for centuries. And all because Gideon trusted God. So, to sum up what we said today, faith means giving up trust in your own resources. And if you're facing something that demands faith, you have a difficulty you can't face on your own. You can't cope with this problem of evil in your own life that just overmasters you again and again. You have a situation emerging that you just can't see a way out of. You're up against something that's just bigger than you are. Faith means giving up your own resources, not trying to get through it by yourself, and simply saying, God, I'm trusting you. You've got to do this through the Spirit of God who's living in me. Otherwise, I'm stuck. Second, faith means facing your difficulties steadily and carefully. Looking at what you're up against and saying, God, show me the way through this. Take me through it. I don't want to just stay oblivious of the problems. I want to see your solution coming out of my difficulties. And third, faith means stepping out in the dark. When you know what you've got to do, just going there, holding the hand of God and realizing he can take you through it. Let me say just one more thing as we finish, because it would be wrong not to. You may not be a Christian here this morning. This may all be very strange thinking as far as you're concerned. And you may be thinking, how can I actually know God for myself? The answer is by faith. Reach out in the dark. Ask him to make himself real to you. And you have hundreds of people in this church this morning who will tell you that is exactly what happens. If you want to know more about that, see somebody at the end. Talk to me if you like. But don't go away from here without realizing that faith can be yours. It's not some quality that some people have got and other people don't. It's something that's there for you. God will bring his reality into your life if you simply ask him to do that. Reminder of the verse once again. The Spirit of God who raised Jesus from the dead lives in Christians. And just as God raised Jesus Christ from the dead, he'll give life to your mortal bodies by the same Spirit living within you. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, that's a really quick canter around the territory this morning and three very simple principles, but oh, how hard they can be to apply to our lives and how much we need to think about them again and again. Help us to live by faith and not by sight. Help us to abandon our own resources and allow the power and the glory to be yours. Help us to face up to the difficulties and just not pretend they're not there, but realize that your power can take us through any obstacle, and help us then step out in the dark and see you do miracles, because we ask it for Jesus' sake. Amen.